What's up, everybody? This is episode 51 of the Operators Podcast. This is Mike Beckham from Simple Modern. I'm back from France, and we are going to talk about today. We're going to talk about personal finances. We're going to talk about Q1. We're going to go in depth with Jason, thinking about what's going on with HexClad and Amazon. Should be a lot of great stuff. Let's get it.
So Mike, did you go to Euro Disneyland?
We did. So, okay. So we go to Paris, and it's like, Paris has a bunch of museums, and I hadn't been there in like 30 years. And I'm like, man, my kids are 12 and 9. They're like, they're going to riot by day 5, you know, just museum after museum after museum. So we didn't tell them, but we scheduled Disneyland Paris right in the middle of the 7 days, so that they'd kind of get a little oasis of fun. So we surprised them by going to Disney Paris halfway through, and they were very appreciative. But as we were just saying, like, my schedule is an absolute nightmare basically upon returning. Does this happen to you guys that when you're out of town that you come back and you basically have 2 weeks worth of appointments in 1 week because you're basically playing catch up from that time that you were out of the office?
Dude, totally. There's no days off. I mean, I guess you can take a day off. The work just gets shifted to the next available day, right? There's very few things you can actually put off. And this is why, if you ever try to talk to an executive or you email them, they don't fucking respond back. It's because they, God forbid, they fucking took a day off to take their kids to Disneyland. And then it's like, yeah, okay, everything shifted till the next leap year until you get that day back in 4 years.
Isn't it better to just be like, listen, I'm out these days, and anything I miss, you know, it's your problem, and like, we'll pick it up in the next week. Like, I have one-on-ones with people now. I'm taking that from Mike. I took a page out of the Mike management.
How's it going? Book. How are your one-on-ones going?
I think they're going well. I mean, I only started them like a couple months ago, but then there are days where it's like, I just like, I have my one-on-ones half a day on Tuesday and half a day on Thursday. Sometimes, like on a day like today, I'm not in the office. We have an event going on. It just so happens that we got rained out at Pebble Beach today. So that event is not until tonight. And like, I'm just, you know what? We're going to just do those calls next week, and you can save it till then. And if anything is important and needs to get done, text me, call me. But like, if I'm out and I miss a bunch of Slacks and emails, it's like, those are missed and you need to come back and get me and figure it out. Like, the catch up thing is like, you can't catch up, dude. It's impossible. Mm-hmm.
Well, for me, it's all the external stuff. I don't know how much you guys feel this, but you know, my role at this point, now that we're over 100 employees, is it's like, I've got my direct reports, but I've got all this external stuff, you know, whether it's the philanthropy stuff we do or entrepreneurship stuff. There's all this like community stuff and like spokesperson stuff, and that's the stuff that stacks up on me. Like you're saying, Jason, hopefully you're training people in your organization where they don't need you around to make decisions. Like if it's something really important, they'll check with you, but like they're not waiting on you to kind of keep running the business. But man, that it's all the other stuff that just stacks for me. And then when I get back, I'm trying to obviously get together with everybody so that I can see what they've been doing the last couple of weeks. But then also I've got all this other stuff. So, but
It sounds like you need to say no to more stuff.
Oh, for sure. For sure, man. This is like a theme of my wife and I's life, is like just saying no more. And I would say the number one thing that I have learned from having more money than I need is how freaking valuable my time is. And that I give it away too freely sometimes. Like, I want to have an attitude of using my time to help other people, but I am just, I've been way too quick with yeses in the past, and I've got to get better at that, because that stuff's precious, man. I can earn more money. I can't earn more time, right?
That's what, I started saying no to so much stuff now. And like fun things too. Like so many, you know, there's all these dinners, you know, let's go to our suite at the Laker game, you know, come to our box at the Yankee game. Like I'm actually really grateful that people think to invite me, but it's just impossible. And a lot of these things, they actually sound like fun, right? Like come on this podcast, do that, do this. But it's not really what I love. And if it's not something that I either I have to love it or I have to do it for some reason, right? Otherwise, nope. You know, just not gonna do it.
If it's a business thing, does it help you generate demand? Does it help you capture demand? And if it's not doing one of those things, it's like, why the fuck am I doing it? And I would even put that through all of your meetings and anyone who comes and checks with you. It's like, is this helping us generate demand or capture demand in some way? And if it's not, why am I looped in? Because at the end of the day, as a CEO, you're only judged on either top line or bottom line or both, right? So it's like, if you're not protecting those two things, why do you care about, oh, this person actually wants a promotion, or this person's mad about this other person said something to him, or whatever, that is this helping you grow top line or bottom line? Oh no, I don't even want to hear about it. So that's why you need like good executives to manage all those things, because they are important. But the personal shit you guys are talking about, it's like, yeah, man. I mean, the bigger your company gets, like people invite you to things just to try to sell you shit. And I really don't want to go to those, right? That's most of the dinners, the boxes, whatever. And it's like, if you really got to just like maybe hire a double of yourself. Be like, this is actually Jason.
My surrogate, like yeah. In Arrested Development, I have a surrogate. So I'll tell you guys, this is an example of what you're talking about, Sean. Like I have all these nonprofits that I actually really believe in. I love them. But every nonprofit has a banquet, right? Where they try and raise money. And the banquets have like some kind of a similar format where it's like they talk some and then they have a charity auction at the end. And, you know, generally when I get these invitations to banquets, I just say, no, you know, I can't. But the banquet, the nonprofits are smart. And so they realize if I put you in the program, or if I'm going to give you an award or something, then maybe you'll come to the banquet. And so there was a nonprofit that I love the nonprofit, but they asked me, hey, will you be involved in the program? And they'd asked me like 3 years in a row. And so I'm finally like, okay. So I go, and then, you know, there's a charity auction and I feel bad not participating. And there's four Thunder courtside tickets to a game that I already have two courtside tickets that I already can't use because I have another commitment on that night. I bid on this package. I win four additional Thunder courtside tickets. I now have six Thunder courtside tickets to a Spurs Thunder game. Wembanyama, it's like, this is a game that would actually be fun. I'm giving them all away. This is a microcosm of my life because I can't go to the game anyway. But yeah, absolutely. Like you start to see all of like the subtle ways that people make bids for your time. And man, if I don't like have a pretty hard line and a pretty high standard, I look up and it's like, how did I get all this stuff on my calendar?
Dude, totally. And there's like stuff you want to do that's actually fun. And then everything else is just bullshit. Bid on time, I think, is so, it's like exactly what's happening. And don't you just miss the days when you were just actually building something? Like Jason was talking about, oh, he's got this event, he's got to go do this thing. It's like, yeah, the bigger you get, you just become a mascot, kind of. You're just like kind of running around like the face or representation of Ridge. And that's what like public CEOs are. They're just a mascot. They have no fucking real control over their businesses. And if anyone's listening and they're like, these are just three out of touch people bitching, it's like, appreciate the time you're in right now building your business, because that's actually why we got into it. It's fun.
But I'm also going to give everyone who's like trying to get to people like us, I'm going to give them a little advice. And this is like, I'd say this is kind of the Panzerism of the day. I think it applies across the board on a lot of things. Okay. It's pretty simple. Personalize everything. Like, don't reach out to me and be like, oh, we're going to Lakers game, blah, blah. Do you even know if I like the league? Like, find something, figure out what it is that I really like. And dude, I will figure out a way to show up. Personalize everything. It's even like with the cold reach out emails. It's just amazing. And the Twitter DMs, it's just amazing how little thought anyone puts into this stuff. And a little bit of like Roman was asking about, you know, how do I, how did I used to write my reach out emails as an investment banker? Because I sent a ton of cold emails as an investment banker for 12 years. And I was like, it's pretty simple. Personalize it. Demonstrate your credibility and why it applies to them, and like figure out how to get their attention. You know, like if someone sends me an email with in the subject line saying, I fucking love Hexclad, like I'm going to read the email. It's but if you send me one that says quick question, I'm going
oh,
to
that's
automatically
an auto delete.
Delete it.
I've got a filter, and if the words quick question are in your email, it goes into a special folder that I never look at.
That's hilarious, yeah. Dude.
But like so, but this is a good one. So this guy's I think you're talking to them. Saris, they're like the data warehouse, they're doing like data warehouse work. I like them. We just started using them. We don't have anything done yet, but like they're good guys. Indian firm, and they hired a really great guy in the US who's kind of like just out there banging the drum. And Mark. And Mark and I have been going back and forth because he's a really good golfer, and we've been going back and forth about getting together, and we finally found a date. And he took me to like an incredible golf club. And you know what? That's how you win. Like, that's how you win. Find something that Sean Frank likes, you know? Go do an elliptical session with Sean Frank. But you're like, you got to personalize it. It's like, it's not that hard.
Dude, totally. Especially like, you know, the three of us are more public than most people. And so you could find stuff for us. But Jason, if I could summarize your panzerism, this is advice I got one time. If you want to go to cool parties, you got to be cool at parties, right? And that like, if you want my attention, you got to be worth having my attention. So, you know, I was talking to Jeremy, friend today, and he sent some news over that broke on Twitter like 6 weeks ago. And I'm like, you have to tweet more. And he's like, that's the worst advice I've ever got. Right. And then Isaac, our friend, was like, I posted on Twitter that I wanted to talk to VCs and I got 15 VC intros. It's like, Jeremy's like, oh, maybe I should be on Twitter. And one of the largest YouTube channels on earth cold DM'd me and was like, hey, can I have your advice on business? And that's a good example of someone who will get my time because of how cool and interesting they are. Right. That is being cool at a party to go to cool parties. So all I'm trying to say is if you want our attention, if you're trying to sell something, just it has to be personalized. It has to be worth our effort because a million people hit us up every single day.
Well, you're making, yeah, that's the point is just, you know, empathy. We've talked about this before. Empathy is the ability to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and understand how they're experiencing the world. And you just, time is so precious and so like there's so many things clawing at it when you're leading a company that's at scale that it's the people that seem to get that. And because they get how like limited your time is that they go that extra step to really to spend 15 or 20 minutes crafting a good email. They go that extra step to understand, you know, what is it that what's a way that I can add value to Sean? I mean, one thing I will say, this is the kind of stuff that gets me in trouble, but I love doing it. Like I'll respond. So in Twitter, you've got DMs that come from people you follow. And then you've got, you know, the rando Twitters, which is basically like the sex bots and, you know, the crypto bros. But I'll have a bunch of people that'll show up that I don't follow. That'll be like, hey, I listened to the pod, you know, like I love it. I have this business question. I know you're probably too busy, but if you could give me any help. And I've had some of those where I just, you know, I do help them because all three of us, the other thing that's true, Sean, you had a great tweet about this. I think it was last week about how basically no one that has built anything of substance has a big head because there's so much failure and so much, you know, getting your butt kicked basically that happens along the way that by the time you get to a really big company, you're not beating your chest. I also think that that's the reason why people like us, even though like time's really precious, there is a desire to help other people because we all got that from people along the way. And we know how hard it is to build something. So I'm always trying to balance that of like, hey, how much do I say yes to people that are right in the midst of it and trying to figure it out? It's why we started the podcast is we want to help people like that. But it's the people that personalize it. Like I'll give an example. There's a guy, Mari from Fortuny. He's running this brand. It's 100-something-year-old company out of Venice. Makes like this crazy premium cloth. The stuff's like $400 a yard. And Kim Kardashian and Taylor Swift and all these people use it. And he's trying to figure some stuff out. Showed up randomly in my DMs. And I was like, you know, hey, he told a good story. It was really interesting. I'd love to learn about it. I said, sure, let's hop on a call. So like, I think that it's a great point that especially when you're running a company at our scale, what's interesting to me is not money. Like when people that are coming at me and saying, hey, here's an opportunity to make more money. It's more when people are interesting and I can learn more about the world through them. And that's kind of the point you were making, Sean, is that to some extent, we're at a stage in our career where what we really traffic in is information and interesting people that help us to think differently. And that when you can show that you're that type of a person, like that's, or that you're somebody that is, you know, really doing the thing that we could potentially help, like those are the things that usually trigger me considering saying yes.
Dude, totally. I mean, dude, it's so funny. Jason's eating lunch and he's using the Hexclad Peppermill.
I got the Peppermill. You got one of these, Sean, right?
I have more Hexclad than any other Hexclad.
Wait, now we got to get the, now we got the salt mill.
We are moving into our new house in like 4 months and I'm already planning on just coming and dropping like, I don't know, whatever it costs to hex out that entire kitchen. Hey, do you have your Hexclad water bottle? Those were pretty sweet. The water bottles that
we sent. I had to get on my team because we had like boxes of these things and they were like waiting for a special occasion to give them to the team. I'm like, what are you waiting for? Just give them out. Like they're sitting in the box, like clogging up the office. These things are awesome. Yeah, I have mine in the office. It's great. Thank you.
Nice.
I'm also waiting for Matt to redo in the Hexclad phone cases. They look really awesome. He's supposed to set that up.
Dude, Hexclad ad plug. Just use code operators. You'll get 90% off your order. Just joking. No, but Mike, you know what you're talking about is getting really big is really hard and you fail all the way up, right? Like, and I always bring this up. 10 years ago, I probably made like $50,000 a year or less, right? I didn't have a car like 7 years ago. So it's like, I was totally fucking broke trying to figure my life out. And like, I happened to end up here. So I have a lot of empathy for anybody building in those early stages, right? And I want to help them and I want to, you know, be as much of a guide as I could be because people guided me in my career that whole time. So anyway, if you're trying to get our attention, be interesting, be cool, or be totally struggling and failing, and maybe we'll talk to you.
So as anybody who listens to the show knows, having an ERP solution is an absolute must as you grow. There's just no other way to stay organized. What you may not know about having an ERP, and I've personally experienced, is that over 50% of ERP implementations fail. I cannot overstate how much money has been spent, has set on fire and spent trying to set up an ERP only to lead into frustration. So that's why it's so important that you make the right choice for your business when you're thinking about implementing an ERP and why Fulfill is one of the sponsors of the podcast. When it comes to running an e-com business, Fulfill is a fantastic solution that was designed for businesses that are primarily digital. We personally have gone through, three ERP implementations in my career, and I've seen how doing it the right way is a big part of success. But the other big part of success is picking a partner whose tool is really built for your company and what your company does. So if you're a listener to this podcast and you have an e-commerce focused business, Fulfill is an excellent option to be checking out for your ERP solution.
So all of our net worth is basically in an illiquid asset, right? It's in private company stock. And by owning that stock over time, you either sell it and you make, you know, a big capital gains exit, or you can get distributions through dividend recap, something like that. So that's how your private stock becomes valuable. And because of that, I'm already in like the riskiest asset class ever, right? That I have a lot of leverage over. I put all my money in treasuries or the S&P 500. And then just like maybe 100K is in random gambles. And Jason always gives me shit about that. But Mike, how about you? How are you thinking about it?
Well, I mean, I think obviously that's the big question is entrepreneurship is basically this idea of I'm going to funnel all of my capital towards a private, illiquid, concentrated bet. And then the question is, when do you start to like unwind that, right? So for me, I did the math and I think my initial seed investment was $200,000. I think our most recent valuation, you know, is coming in higher than that, let's say. it's up, you know, whatever, 1200x or something, some kind of crazy number. So 2000x. The question is, at what point do you start to unwind that? And then my other question is, you know, because we're growing, we've grown, the valuation's grown tremendously over the last couple of years. So I'm trying to figure out that piece of like, okay, as your valuation's growing, and I don't want to sell the company. So like, okay, what do you do there? There's some things like dividend recaps. But the strategy I'm taking on like personal finances has been that I'm taking every week, I have several transfers that happen out of my account. So my primary checking account, I've got a transfer to Ameritrade, and that money goes straight to Ameritrade, and then it goes into VTI, which is Vanguard Total Index. And I do it every single week. So instead of getting like concentrated, making all my buy at one particular time, I'm like, I'm going to pick an amount every single week. I do the same thing with Coinbase that goes into Bitcoin and Ethereum. And then I have a similar one that goes into a Merrill Lynch account, a couple thousand dollars. That's mostly treasuries. And then there's this other thing I use called Titan, which I think I do a few thousand dollars a week, where again, it goes into this tax optimized best treasury thing. And so I have several pieces like that that just happen every week. It's more like brushing your teeth. Like, I'm going to get myself on a cadence, and I'm not going to try and time the market, but I'm going to be trying to just really methodically every week, I'm moving money over into these asset classes. But you said it, Sean, like, man, when treasuries are, and you can have money just earning interest at 5.something%, it's pretty difficult to not get excited about that, right? So that's a big chunk of what I've done. And the other thing you got to worry about, like, when, I don't know if you guys think about this stuff, but when you start to get a lot of liquid wealth, you can't put it all in one account, or you probably shouldn't, because FDIC only goes up to a certain level. So the government insures your liquidity up to a certain level. And if you have all your liquidity in a bank, and hypothetically that bank, you know, went, became insolvent, you're not guaranteed that all that money's safe over a certain level. So I've got some kind of spread out among different banks. But my strategy has really been primarily like, hey, how do I kind of get into a routine where I don't have to think about it a lot every week, but I'm moving money from the bucket of illiquid to more liquid, diversified, appreciating assets, and kind of just starting to make that transition of, and kind of my goal is that percentage of net worth that's in that illiquid stock is going down gradually over time. Now, in my case, I don't want to sell the company. So that's taking kind of all the distributions and all the cash flows and things that come out of that and kind of funneling all that stuff to other appreciating assets. And you kind of made this point, Sean, but you're really looking to not be in the same kind of assets in general. Like, I'll occasionally make angel investments. You mentioned Isaac. Like, I'm going to come in on Isaac's round. I know that you're in on that. So there's occasionally people that it's just like, oh, I really believe in this person. But my thought process on that, I heard this on a podcast and I really liked it. If you're going to invest in something, you should have some kind of like, you should be able to state, hey, here is why I'm getting a great price, or I'm getting better than market on this particular investment. So if you're just out there kind of spray and praying with angel investments, like the stats aren't good for you. But if you're like, hey, I actually have like particular insight on this founder or this opportunity, or I'm being given a special opportunity to buy at this, you know, at this valuation because of this way that I bring value to the table. Those are all the opportunities that are the most interesting to me, where I can kind of come up with an investment thesis where I'm going to beat the market and I'm going to do really well because of something unique to my situation or what I bring to the table.
All right, Mike, you covered a lot of ground there. I have specific questions for you, then I'm going to ask the same ones for Jason. So, Mike, I think Simple Modern is incredibly well run, and publicly it's over $100 million a year in revenue. So when was the first year? Flexing on us, dude. Okay.
No, I didn't say it. I'm just holding my pen, Sean.
Okay. But when was the first year that you took $1 million out of Simple Modern?
So I think the first year that I got that kind of liquidity, It was probably two to three years ago. So, I mean, it was very Spartan for a very long time because of the growth rate. And, you know, that we've talked about this before, but it's just like, man, you really, it's really difficult when you're growing. And I don't know what you guys internally use as your metrics on. So we use a return on invested capital metric. If we're going to buy $1 million of inventory, we want to make on average 120% return on that capital in 6 months or something like that. This is what we use internally. And so when you're hitting those kind of numbers and you're growing, it's like, now why would I take money out when I'm hitting basically a 240% annualized return and earn 5% in treasuries, you know, or whatever? And so, like, and part of the answer is, well, if you're not growing, then obviously that makes a lot of sense. But also, like, hey, you're concentrated and it's in this illiquid asset and there's risk and whatever. But so for a long time, it was just like, man, the returns are too good to even think about taking money out. I just want to push every chip back in. And it wasn't really until about 2 or 3 years ago where it was like, okay, some of the investment opportunities that I'm leaving on the table here with Simple Modern are just kind of average to below average ones to take the money out. And the diversification that I'm getting is more powerful than the return that I'm leaving on the table.
Okay. And I just want to, you answered the question. I just want to highlight it. So you see a lot of voices on the internet in our space. I think our space is the second or third most scammy space on the internet. So I think crypto is the most scammy. Then it's like, you know, maybe it's sex work or something, but then e-com is right up there and being like the most scammy shit on the internet. So you see a lot of voices come in and out of it, right? And you'll have people talk about making millions of dollars. And I always try to stress this point to people that until your company is doing $50 million or more, you basically have a minimum wage job because the money you're taking out of your business is so small. And thank you for answering that question, honestly. It's like, dude, Simple Modern was doing $100 million a year before the CEO and founder took $1 million in liquidity. And Ridge, we probably took more liquidity across the years than most. Like I'm able to pull seven figures a year for the past couple of years, right? I mean, probably starting at $100 million and up, and we have a lot of partners in the business. So we've been able to pull out a lot of liquidity. But for most brands, what Mike talked about is the exact right thing, is that your internal rate of return is so high that pulling out capital makes no fucking sense. And either implicitly or, and I guess explicitly, you're figuring that out, right? You're playing poker, but every game you get to start with an extra ace on everybody. That is what owning a business is, right? And so you're pot committed because you keep fucking winning. And the trick is eventually the pocket's so big, you should start taking a couple chips off the table and putting them in your pocket. Jason, does Hexcloud think about this the same way, or what are your guys' idea on liquidity?
It's like each of the owners probably has a different view on liquidity. Like one is like, I've already taken enough out and I'm like ready to swing for the fences on everything else for as long as it takes and I don't care. Another is like, okay, I've done well and I actually really enjoy other things and I want to like go invest elsewhere. I mean, I think we like what Mike said about return on invested capital and things like that, you know, that was interesting. You know, we basically run the business to a minimum EBITDA margin, and we just run it to a minimum EBITDA margin because we want to be a profitable business. And that way we have options, right? That way we have options of what to do with our capital. And, you know, on the overall sort of like personal investing front, I went through the torture of getting a CFA. I don't know if you guys know what that is actually, but that's what like the portfolio managers have. That's not a CFP, which is like the certified financial planner that like your stockbroker gets. This is like 3 years of intense, like ridiculousness, derivatives, fixed income, portfolio management, like mind-numbing stuff that when I was in my 30s, I thought was a good idea. And now looking back, it probably was a waste of my time. But that it's taught me to think about everything is a portfolio. and you need to think about everything as a in a portfolio approach. And as you mentioned, Sean, we all have significant net worth tied up in private companies here, and private companies that are basically that, like, that's the riskiest equity out there. Illiquid private company stock.
Yeah, I mean, they talk about the illiquid piece for a second, because I don't think illiquid says it strong enough. You cannot get your money, right? Like, it's basically pretend money. It's so illiquid. Like, if you invest in a private company, if you should expect to not be able to get that money is gone forever for 10 years. Like, you cannot touch it at all. And anything better than that is just an unbelievable outcome.
Yeah. If you're a passive investor or just a non-control investor in a private company, I mean, that's just like, that should be like a tiny sliver of your portfolio based on your risk tolerance, based on everything else that's in your portfolio. And you're right. You should be like, I may never see this money again. And in the public equity markets, you shouldn't put any money in the public equity markets that you need to tap within the next 5 years. Because, I mean, you could have a down market for a while. And so it's like, if you look at the historical returns on public equity markets, it's really, timing is everything. When you got in, when you got out, timing is really everything. So, you know, you take an overall portfolio approach, and then you have to layer onto that the value to you. For example, I have a place in LA, I have a place in Florida, I have a place in Carmel Valley. And those aren't necessarily...
Well, you got one more place in New York, but go ahead.
Okay. So
Jason has so many homes, he's forgetting homes.
True. But like
if you have so many homes that you forget how many you own...
That one I bought for my son, so that one doesn't count. But like you actually gain like enjoyment. You have the enjoyment of your property, right? So that's different. So when I look at my portfolio and how I run my portfolio, number one, I have a great wealth manager at JP Morgan, and they have a great team, and we get access to really good investment ideas and opportunities through that team, that when you're with a wealth manager and you have a good enough portfolio, you at least think you're getting looks at things that like that the ordinary Joe can't get a look at. But I basically give them my money and they're like, here's what we should do. And 99 times out of 100, I'm like, fine. And that's it. And so before portfolio allocation is, you know, maybe I'll be overweighted here or there, depending on how I view the market and the economy. I think a bunch of us have been overweighted with treasuries because or money markets because the yield is pretty good and because we've been concerned about the economy. And a bunch of us, including me, I probably lost out a fair bit because I wasn't allocated enough into equities with like the market having been ripping for a while. But that's okay because I know I'm never going to time the market. I just kind of have a plan, stick to my plan. And, you know, I want to enjoy my fucking life. And I invest in things like that make me happy. I'm not invested in a single private company other than Hexclad, except a modeling and casting agency that's owned by two of my friends. And I did that to help them out because I love
them. That's amazing.
And that's
it. That's amazing. His only other company is a modeling and casting company. So this is, you're getting at something that I want to hear. I want to hear this from you guys. And like, when you have more money than you need, what are you optimizing for? Basically is the question. Like, are you trying to reduce stress? Do you have a financial aspirational goal? Sean, do you want to buy a jet? Like, how do you think about the kind of game and optimization of money when you can't, like, you through living normal life, there's no way you could eat through the amounts of money that we're talking about. How do you think about it?
Yes. So I was on Klaviyo. I just checked. I was paying over $15,000 a month for Klaviyo. And, you know, that is the most Shopify will charge you is $40,000 a month. So they were very quickly approaching half of my overall Shopify bill for just being built on Twilio. I mean, That's what, sorry, Cody. I know you're a Klaviyo believer, but that shit is just built on Twilio. And just so overpriced since it got public. They're just kind of move up market, went to Sendlane. My bill is down 80% plus, exact same fucking shit. I mean, you're going to give up some features because they're a brand new company and they're building them out. Segmentation, they're working on it right now. But seriously, like, we're looking at cutting SaaS costs right now. And like, I save $10,000 a month. That pays for an email manager. That pays for a graphic designer and an email manager. You should definitely think about leaving Klaviyo. It'll be a little bit harder. It'll be a little bit challenging. But can you imagine saving $100,000? In 2014, I made $20,000 a year. Okay, I worked an entire year 10 years ago and I made 20 grand. There's no way I'm giving a fucking email provider fucking $200,000.
Is that when you were folding shirts at Abercrombie?
I probably worked at Brooks Brothers then. I was an intern at Brooks Brothers in 2014 or whatever. But dude, Abercrombie wouldn't hire me. Have you seen the way there's no way I'm getting an Abercrombie, dude. That was for the hot guys. You know, Connor worked at Hollister, so he could get it. Not me though. I'm going to answer your question, but first let's hit on the illiquid point again, because you wanted to hit on it. I want to hit on it. Let's just really beat that home. Jason's equity is so incredibly valuable. It's the most valuable thing he owns, more valuable than his house, more valuable than anything. To the right person, to 99% of investors, it is worth $0. Like if he goes to fucking some family office, he has to explain what HexCloud is. He has to explain what his shares is. He has to show his operating agreement. It's a non-controlling interest in a privately held company that, you know, maybe most people haven't fucking heard of yet, right? Unlike a Stripe, which has, you know, institutional investors and those investors want some more money or whatever else, it's essentially a bootstrap business. I think you can use Ridge as another example. My equity to me is worth hundreds of millions of dollars. To anyone who's never heard of Ridge Wallet, it's worth zero fucking dollars. And until proven otherwise, it's probably worth $0. So I get distributions. That's awesome. I get fucking a salary, whatever. But I just want to really hit on the point that everyone talks about how valuable equity is. Sometimes 99% equity expires, you're worthless, right? Or at least options expire worthless. So just something to think about.
Well, and practically, like, let's just to riff on it just a little bit more. Practically, you are not going to recognize money from that equity when you still need money, is basically the way in e-com in our industry. If you were in tech, that might be different. It might be like you start a company and then you're still pretty kind of Spartan in your lifestyle and in your liquid net worth. And then boom, there's a liquidity event. Google takes you out. Your equity is now worth $50 million. And like, that's the event. It just doesn't tend to happen that way in consumer. It's like either you're going to be successful and you're profitable and that's leading to dividends and distributions and that's the reason why somebody wants to buy you, and then your equity turns into cash, but it's at a point where you already have some cash built up, or you don't build something that's generating profit and that equity is going to zero anyway. Would you guys agree with that statement?
Mike, that is so fucking accurate that the people who get uber rich in consumer are already rich by the time they get uber rich, because it's a golden goose the whole way up, right? It might start with silver eggs instead of gold, but like that goose is laying something. So I think that's totally right.
Jason, as a side note, this is how we decided. Part of the reason, there were a number of different reasons why we decided to become an ESOP. Just for everybody listening, we've talked about this before. Simple Modern started an employee stock ownership plan. That means that every single person that works at the company gets some equity. But part of the thought process for me was basically my hit was going to be over a 10-year period, it might hit me 2% on an ownership basis or something like this. Now that 2% for me and, you know, another couple percent coming through the other owners, like it's several percent and that could be tens of millions of dollars. But my perspective was like the difference between me being worth, you know, whatever, $250 million and $270 million is zero in terms of how my life, I experience my life, my quality of life, anything else. But that $20 million now in an ESOP that's benefiting everyone in my company is potentially life-changing. And that's a very easy trade-off to make. And I think this is one of the hardest things about doing the mental exercise of money is that your entire life you have this like, man, if I had more money, I would do X or I would do Y or that would unlock this. And then you get to a point where it's like, no, the unlock is nothing. In fact, it starts to, I saw somebody tweet this today and I think it might be right. There may be a point as you start to get into tens or hundreds of millions of dollars where the marginal utility of money starts to turn negative. And, you know, there's more risk of your kids blowing themselves up. There's more risk of like, you know, whatever, somebody embezzling money from you. And so for me, like, I think this is one of the fun things that it's unlocked is that the ability to think about giving and the ability to think about how you help other people win gets bigger because functionally, you're not going to be able to make any kind of meaningful difference to your life, whether that number goes up or down 10, 15, 20%, whatever.
Hell yeah, dude. And now I'm going to answer your question. What the fuck is the point of having extra money? Or what do you do with extra money?
Yeah, what do you do with it? What are you optimizing for?
Yeah, so let's talk about like the goal, like just goals real quick. I love Ridge. It's a great business. I'm going to work here as long as I can. But I've been very public that Ridge, the biggest we can possibly be is $5 billion. That is what Yeti's worth. You know, Tapestry, which is a publicly held accessories company, is probably worth $8 billion. But like that's the ceiling of our types of businesses, right? Like it's not a marketplace like Amazon or Walmart. It is not a monopolistic tech company. We're not doing anything in hard technologies. Like it's very hard for us to be worth more than $10 billion. And I grew up poor. And I'm totally fine going back there. Like, I think you're probably, it's better to raise your kids from a place of poverty than from a place of wealth. So what's the point of having all the extra money? It's just so that I can go do another bigger thing, right? I really like doing really cool, big things. The Mark Cass Brownlee deal or getting Ridge to this point. I've pushed Ridge to be bigger than any of the original founders wanted it, or even Connor wanted it to be. Like they all thought that like 100 million was crazy, right? So I really like when the games are really big. I think it's cool. You get to do the coolest things. Anyway, that's what I really enjoy. So money is just a tool to get that done, right? Like I need to have an exit in Ridge just to prove to everybody I can do exits so that they'll give me $1 billion in invested capital so that I can go do a really crazy big thing. Like I want to do space manufacturing, or I want to fucking put a colony on Mars or something like that. That's like the fun game I'm trying to play. And I'm 30 now. So hopefully in the next, you know, sub 5 years, I get that big exit so that I can go out there and do this thing.
So John, when you hit the nail on the head, you're 30 now. And that's a big reason, like that's what you have your life and your wishes and your responsibilities. And your age, like also you're a very specific person. Like that's what you enjoy. Like that's actually fun to you. You want to do that because that that's what excites you. Everyone has what excites them. And I think things change over time. So I'm very curious to hear, like, I'm curious to hear Mike's response to this. We'll go up the age ladder, right? So Sean, you did yours. Mike, you do yours and then I'll do mine.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the most profound things, it is funny to me that the more I think about this stuff and the more money is just kind of around, the more that I keep coming back to these like terms that, you know, like illiquid and time value of money and risk reward, you know, that we learn at the very beginning, but they mean more to you. And this piece that you're talking about now, Jason, the time value of money is a profound concept. The more I think about it, the more I'm like, this is just an absolutely profound idea. The way that I express it most simply is, let's take the idea of a family vacation. If I take my kids are 12 and 9. If I say, I'm going to take an extra $10,000 out of the company and I'm going to go on vacation today. Or I could leave that $10,000 in the company and I can earn 100% return on it. And 5 years from now, you know, it could be $70,000 and then I could take it out and go on vacation. It doesn't matter that it's $70,000 5 years from now, because my kids aren't going to be 12 and 9 anymore. And they're not going to want to go to Disney World. The time value of money is locked in the fact that my ability to do a particular thing with that money is bound in the universe of time. And once I miss that opportunity, it does not matter how much more of the money I have. I can't go back and get that and I can't retrieve that. And that life is kind of this game of understanding that if I am willing to push off with my money, that I have more of it in the future. But if you push off too much, what's the point in having the money at all? Because you don't get to do any of the things that matter with the people that you want to do them with. So I'm kind of probably in between, Jason, in that I have to have some kind of a mind towards the future, but I'm still young enough at 44 that I don't have to be like in conversion to liquidity mode. And I'm probably at least 5 or 10 years away from even having to really seriously start to move down that path. And I can kind of, for the most part, I can kind of think in kind of building terms, and it's okay that a bunch of my net worth is still pretty illiquid. So I do think, Sean, what you said is really interesting and compelling, and I'd call it out, which is you're kind of wanting to take your winnings and roll them into a thing that drives quality of life for you, which is building something significant that you couldn't do otherwise. And interestingly, like Bezos was on Lex Fridman's podcast, and that is pretty much exactly what he said Blue Odyssey is. Blue Odyssey is him taking all of his winnings from Amazon, which is obviously far more than he could ever use in his lifetime, and just funneling those into building kind of the infrastructure that hopefully will make possible a lot of different space things in the future that aren't possible today. And I think that's a really like noble thing for entrepreneurs. When entrepreneurs say like, I'm going to take my winnings and I'm going to lay the foundation that future generations of entrepreneurs are going to be able to build awesome stuff on top of, and I'm going to get the enjoyment of helping build that foundation. So that really resonates with me, as does the giving stuff. But today it's mostly, I need to be liquid enough that I'm not saying no to opportunities when it comes to my family and my friends that I would regret not taking at this point in time. And as long as I've got enough liquidity for that, I'm okay. So like another example right now is like we're building a pool, like we're building a new house, but really the only reason we're building a new house is we want a pool. And the reason we want a pool is my kids are 12 and 9 and their friends will want to come over and swim in the pool. And so like, you know, yeah, I want to be able to build a pool and not think about it. And that's an important for this kind of moment in time, but I don't need $10 million to build a pool. You know, pools are like $150,000. And so I just need to be liquid enough that purchases like that are easy and don't create a lot of, you know, brain damage.
I wish your Oklahoma pool guy could come to my house.
Yeah. What do they cost in California, Jason?
I want to vomit just thinking about it. So I'm not going to talk about it.
Is it over under 500,000?
Okay. Since I got two quotes, 390 and 500. Those are the two quotes.
Is there a grotto? Is there some kind of like special feature here that we should know about?
Well, my house is on the top of a mountain, so it makes it difficult. But.
That is harder.
Okay, I just want to add one other dimension to what Mike was talking about. Health. So it's time and it's money, and then there's health, right? Like you can have all the time in the world. If you're not healthy, you fucking, it's worthless, right? Same thing with money, same thing with everything else. So stay in good shape.
I want to tell you a story. I want to say a story about that, Sean. So in a previous life, worked with my brother. We had this auction company. And got pretty big. And about 3 years in to this auction company, a guy in Oregon filed a class action lawsuit against us. Now, it turns out that the guy in Oregon who filed the suit, who was just a, you know, regular guy, quote unquote, he filed it with a guy that he had previously been legal partners with. And this guy was a class action attorney that was actually one of the ones that was involved in the tobacco settlement. So this guy, I think, or one of the big settlements. So this is a class action attorney that's made a whole bunch of money, tens, hundreds of millions, I don't know, a lot. And he and his ex-law partner decided that if his ex-law partner would be, you know, the representative of the plaintiff class, they could file a class action lawsuit against us. Which didn't really have merit, but that's another, you know, don't even get me started on class action lawsuits. Not the point of this story. So this thing goes for years. I would say 3 years, we probably had $8 million in the litigation of this. It hadn't gone to trial. I mean, just like, it's just amazing. The reason why these lawyers are so successful is it's so freaking expensive. So back and forth, back and forth. We make reasonable offers. They're never accepted. The lawyer's stance is couldn't possibly settle this for less than $10 million. Just wouldn't even consider it. Get a call one day. That lawyer got diagnosed with cancer and he was ready to sell it for $50,000. And it went away that day because he got cancer. And you know what? Once you have cancer, it really reframes everything. And that, anyway, so that's my story about your point, Sean, that, you know, all of this stuff, health will reframe the way you think about money in a hurry.
Dude, totally. Good lesson. Now, Jason, tell us how you're thinking about liquidity.
Well, okay, but I think it's tied up in what you just said, Sean. Like what we talked about is you want to, I think the next step is you doing something that you find exciting and interesting. And I think in your mind, you kind of know what that is, right? Like, well, you just want to build the next big thing. Sean's goal is eventually, whenever it happens and we exit Ridge, I'm going to go and build something else because I like building. And I think that's really cool. Also, you're young enough where you got a bunch of swings at the plate still. And I think it's probably the same for Mike and it's the same for me, but like there's a slightly different spin on it. I like to do the things that interest me. And I don't know what the next one is after Hexclad yet because I'm so focused on Hexclad. But like I was a lawyer. That was very interesting to me. Then I got, did that for 4 years. I'm like, then the dot-com era came. And like, oh, there's all these internet companies. And oh, one of these I know is raising a bunch of money and they need a guy like me. Yeah, that should be fun. Let's go make our fortune in the dot-com bubble, which burst. And when I was there, I was like, I wound up being kind of like the acting CFO of this company. What would be really good is like to have a finance background and not just be like a lawyer who's a CFO. And so then I went to Columbia Business School. I thought that would be interesting to me. And, while I was at Columbia, I did my CFA. And then I got a job as a CFO of a tech company. And so it's like the next interesting thing, it's just not there for me yet. But in terms of like liquidity for me, I just want to have enough so that I know my kids are set, so that I can live my life. And actually, I know someone, with a really good couple of people with really substantial portfolios. And here's the way they think about it. And I think probably the way I would think about it over the long term is like I need enough capital invested so that I can live off that to satisfy my financial obligations and needs of my daily life. And then if I have that, then I can figure out what else I want to do. Then I can figure out what swings I want to make. But that's, that's a luxury. Those are, I'm going to be 53 in a month. Like that's a luxury that you get there at a certain point. You're like, okay, I want to have enough to make sure my kids are set, my wife is set, and I can live off that. And then after that, I can sort of like take swings. I think the founders of Hexclad and I, like none of us are kids. And, at some point it's like, how long do you want to do this for? But we're also willing to be patient because, we don't need the money. Like, and we're having a great time.
Dude, totally. And Jason, 53, one, you've already had fucking 10 careers in your life, right? Like you've done it all. You got another one in you after, if you guys ever exit Hexclad. 53 is the new 35, dude. I mean, you're going to be 80 fucking doing business deals. You just know you're one of those guys. So I think you got a long time.
We use Northbeam. We've been on it pretty much since day one. We've used other attribution tools in the past and they just were not nearly good enough for us. We found Northbeam to be way more reliable. We use it on all of our channels. My number one rule is, don't trust somebody based on their reporting if they have a financial incentive to make it look better. So I don't want to know what Meta says Meta is providing or Google says Google is providing. I want to know what they're actually doing and having a way where we can compare directionally across them. So we're on it for MTA. We're also on it for MMM, which I'm a huge fan of and has made a huge difference.
Their MMM is actually getting better every day. That's one thing that I've noticed. And I was just talking to Austin and it was a little bit like duct tape and chicken wire at the beginning. But it's definitely getting really good. And in addition, that whole question about like Amazon versus D2C, they're actually helping us understand and answer that question, which is really cool.
Yeah, you guys did good ad reads. I was just going to say, Austin's very handsome. So if you want a very handsome CEO leading your SaaS products, he's the best in the biz.
You want to do a quick, let's do a quick Q1 recap. Because I have, you know, the one thing, and I've said this a few times, the one thing that I've seen in Q1, which is really interesting to me, and I'm trying to figure out, is like, why is our Amazon business ripping compared to D2C? Like, ripping. And it just, it's going to take time to get through the data and really think about it. And that's what I said to the guy at Saris the other day. I'm like, help me figure out that. Like, and I'm sure they don't have any golden, special answer or smoking gun for it. But like, it's just really weird to me that something happens. I don't know what we did. And it just goes to show you, like, a lot of things that happen in your business, you have no idea why. Like, you have no idea why. And so the thing about Q1 for us is it was solid. January was a little soft, but because over year over year, but that's because December was a monster in 23, and December 22, we had stockout issues. So the comparison of January over January wasn't great. And that's actually really important to do. When you look at the numbers, I see this all the time. It's like, you got to ask why, and you got to look at like what's changed. You got to look at year over year, but don't just take the number and like, oh yeah. So January we thought was a little soft. February was great. We always do a big deal in February for President's Day. For some reason in our space, that kind of always rips. And March was solid too. We've dropped a few new products which have done really well, like our pizza steel. But it's the one thing that I'm scratching my head about and trying to figure out, and I need some like D2C wisdom out of all you guys, is like, why is Amazon ripping compared to D2C?
Yeah. You know, I just have some theories. I'm looking at your Amazon SERP. So when people type in Hexclad into Amazon, and I'm going to point out a couple of things. You have great listings. So if you look for Hexclad on Amazon, you have 6-7 of the top boxes. And like, it's because you have so many separate listings that all rank really high for Hexclad, and they all have great reviews and great sell through, right? I mean, 4.9 with 638 ratings on your hybrid Dutch oven, best in class. Like, you're beating everybody on there. So your Amazon listings just look great. And there is nobody organically ranking on your keywords besides you. And then the competitors, the knockoffs you have bidding on you, because Amazon is just becoming a knockoff fucking marketplace. 3.0 quart hexagon surface, hybrid steel, whatever. Not a brand. If you click on it, the fucking thing sucks and it has bad reviews. So one, I think your Amazon team's doing a great job. These look great. You're running deals. You have great listings, great reviews, everything. The second thing I'll point to is you're just picking up brand awareness now across TV show placements, TikTok placements, things that are non-direct click attributable, right? Because those people, if they're not clicking and buying from Facebook ads, they're going to search you, and maybe Amazon is bidding on your stuff, but a lot of people just search on Amazon. So, I mean, that is
our marketing mix is potentially moved. Our increased brand awareness plus our marketing mix, yeah, and the fact that we just have this body of work where we've been crushing it on Amazon. I mean, it's pretty amazing. I remember 2 years ago, our Amazon reviews were good, but like not like this now. I mean, they're like 4.98, 4.9. It's like those numbers are like video game for Amazon reviews. So I think it's that combo.
Your best in class Amazon reviews. And yeah, sorry, Mike, I'm gonna let you talk because you're the Amazon expert here. The only other thing I wanna say is really think about the marketing mix. You're featured in 8 TV shows, right? Like, people are wearing Hexclad merch. If you go on TikTok, people are cooking on Hexclads that either influencer partnerships or whatever else. I think because there's no direct link to shop at your store, more of those searches will end up on Amazon than other places. So I think you just have a marketing mix that favors Amazon now, potentially. But go ahead, Mike.
Okay, so a couple things here. This is how I would approach it. And Jason, I'm happy to offline look at some of the stuff for you. The Amazon offers a couple reports that are really insightful. The first one I'm looking at right now is the top search terms report. I mean, one thing to remember about Amazon, it's basically two things at once. It is a second website and it is an organic demand generation tool. So some people on Amazon are searching whatever, you know, nonstick pan, and they're buying Hexclad. And those are people that are really Amazon is bringing to you. They're bringing them to the table. And then Hexclad is popping up somehow. They're seeing the reviews, all the things Sean's talking about, and they're choosing you. And then the other piece of how you're selling on Amazon is people that are going to Amazon and saying, I want to buy a Hexclad pan today. And I'm just choosing to do it from Amazon as opposed to the Hexclad website for whatever reason. I really like next day shipping. I trust Amazon. I had four things I needed to buy and this was just one of them. You know, who knows? So for us, one of the ways you can see this, there's a couple different ways, is you can look at your key terms. I mean, you do have, last week you had a top three, you had a top 3,000 keyword and another top 10,000. So you have a couple of top 10,000 keywords. Those things really matter as that number gets lower and lower, the amount of volume is really ramping up. So this is one of the things that our team tracks internally is what are your key terms? How many key terms are you getting in the top, you know, let's say 100,000 or 50,000? And then how are those ranks moving over time? We have a big report where we watch this. There's another report Amazon offers, which I think is the single best report it's ever made. I've written a Twitter thread on this, but it's a report that actually allows you to see what are the things that people are searching before they buy your stuff. So this is incredibly insightful because it allows you to see, if you think about your listings as a room, there's a bunch of doors. Amazon has all these different doors that people could be taking to get into that room. And depending on what door they take, that has different implications of like why you're getting so many more people in the room. Is it our advertising? Is it a bunch more people are showing up on Amazon and searching Hexclad? Is it we're just getting a bigger share of the number of people that are searching for nonstick pan? Are there a lot more people searching for nonstick pan than there were a year ago? And this report is the key to kind of answering that question. Why are so many more people buying our stuff? And we lean really heavily on that report. So it'll let you to see not just what's happening on Hexclad key terms, but it'll also allow you to see where all the other traffic is coming from and proportionally how it divides out. Super helpful tool. In some ways, I can't even believe Amazon actually made it available because for years I wanted it and they didn't have it. But the going back to my point about Amazon being two things, at this point for us, more than 50% of our sales on Amazon are people that are showing up and searching Simple Modern water bottle, Simple Modern tumbler, whatever, that they are just using Amazon like our website. And it makes sense because, you know, like I said, they want next day shipping or whatever. And generally we see this to be true. Maybe some of it has to do with the price point of our product, that when we're offering something that's really unique ornamentation or that's only available on the website usually does way better than Amazon. But if we put the same thing on Amazon and the website, over time, the volume just drifts towards Amazon and the website is a, you know, will be whatever, 1/10 of Amazon because Amazon has such an amazing fulfillment network. So there's a way to untangle these things. And Amazon does provide a bunch of reports that'll help you to do it.
These are great insights, guys. Thank you. I think we just dropped a good amount of Amazon knowledge. So at least we got into some of the stuff other than talking about our own money today. love it. No, that's I'm gonna have my team pull those for me, Mike. But it's super interesting because it's just the disparity is so large now. And it really kind of started back in January. So I just feel like there's more to the equation here. There are more variables in the equation, but that's probably a pretty good summary.
Yeah, dude, you have a great looking Amazon. So shout out to the team running it. Now, let me ask you, how is the rest of Q1? Do you feel good about it?
Yeah, I do feel good about it. Our international business is ripping because we just started a bunch of new territories. Like we started Canada and Australia both in Q4, D2C, and they're both outperforming. UK has really picked up. March was really good for us in the UK. And, you know, our overall D2C, US D2C, like, keeps on chugging. But I think I said this on the last pod, like, I think we are, we're not going to grow 100%+ this year like we did the last 2 years in a row. It just gets really hard. But I think we can grow north of 50 this year.
It's a beautiful business, man. International
is a good part of it. A good part of it is international.
Yeah. And then, I mean, product expansion. I think that's how you get back to the triple digit growth, right? I think, and I know you guys are cooking up a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah. In fact, this is a little inside, insider deal. We have a couple of really big things that we're working on, and we're considering waiting till January to drop them, you know, just to kind of like smooth out the numbers. Cause it's like, how much growth do you really need?
Totally.
And you know, so that's another thing that you kind of, as you get big enough, you gotta start to manage that, especially if you're maybe an IPO one day, which we could be.
Dude, the other thing is, it's too late in the year to plan a Q4 launch. That's my honest opinion. Brand new product, brand new category, like what you're working on. We're planning 2026 now. Like, you have to think that far in advance with a business like this. Like, getting supply chains up, making sure you keep shit in demand. That's something I think we fucked up with luggage. We rushed to get luggage out there, and we're out of stock like again today. So it's like, and it's the worst thing because you can't get the Amazon flywheel going. You can't get your marketing flywheel going. You just continue to run out of stock of these things. So, dude, totally. I mean, why even January? Push it to fucking President's Day 2025. That's what I would
do.
Well, to your point, Sean, one of the things that, you know, throughout the literature, I've been reading a bunch of stuff. You have to invest in growth before you need it, because otherwise, it's just not going to be able to deliver what you need it to when you want it to. So luggage is a perfect example. Luggage is ripping for you, but it's just too early for you to be buying enough for it to be making a massive material impact to your top line. There's just a ramp up period, right? It's just going to take time. And so Amazon, Bezos would use this analogy of planting saplings and giving trees time to grow. And I think, Jason, with how you're situated, to some extent, it's like, if you're growing, if you're in the nine figures and you're growing 100%, that we've talked about it before, but that feels way scarier than stacking 2 years of, you know, 40% growth together, back to back. And that the game, I really think, as you start to get big, is, can I stack 10 years of 15 to 20% growth? And do I have a roadmap to do that? Because that's really what the market will reward and what investors will reward, is that you truly have, and the way that you do that is by, you have a really rich portfolio and you have things that are seedlings right now, but 6 years from now could be producing meaningful growth. If every time you have a great idea, you rush it to market and you try and get maximum gain out of it, you're going to get more growth in the short term. You're going to have more risk in the short term. But I don't even know that you're creating more enterprise value, because you're not necessarily demonstrating that you have this organizational capacity and competence of creating consistent growth over time. And that's what investors want to see and reward companies for.
Now, right, you're Jason? Right. And the company that I worked for back in from 2005 to 2008, a company called FactSet, public company, New York Stock Exchange, ticker FDS. I was head of corporate development there. And they had this like incredible SaaS product that, before anyone knew what SaaS was, for financial analysis. And these guys just like for years grew 30% with a 40% EBITDA margin, because they're a tech company. And like, they managed to just put up those numbers, and their stock was always rewarded for it. I think we actually grew too fast last year. Like, we should have grown less. And the curve would look a lot more reasonable. So now, like, seeing 110% last year and seeing like 60% this year is kind of painful to me.
It feels like a letdown, and that's insane.
It's great, even though it's fucking insane. Yes. Everyone's like, wow, you should be like, you know, we're still windmill dunking on everyone. Right?
Totally, dude. The US economy is based on hexclad. That's what I'm learning. The D2C economy is based on hexclad. Yeah, you know, talking about luggage and like what you guys are saying is like slowing launches and like, you know, taking your time forward, ramping up. The most, we're ordering the most amount of luggage we can, and we might be able to do $30 or $40 million in top line this year. And it's like, that is us maxing out a manufacturer. So it's like, you can't do more than that in your first year is what we've learned. Like with all of the money on earth, with all of the marketing on earth, like it just takes a very long time for that ramp up. It'll take 3 years to get to $100 million a year business, even if demand's there tomorrow because of the ramp up. And so I don't think there's any rush or pressure for you. If you have growth currently, I mean, 50% growth is a great target, Jason. So, I mean, you're already beaten best in class, dude. But Mike, how's Q1 for you, dude? You feeling good?
Yeah, I mean, Q1 was, for us this year, is ton of growth last year. We should be over the 200 mark this year. And so it's a combination of consolidating all the gains we made last year while simultaneously doing exactly what we're talking about, setting ourselves up for years of success in the future. And so there's some stuff in kind of how we're going to position ourselves in the market and the investments we're making. So we're making we're setting up a lot of moves, basically, is the way I would say Q1 is. Q1, I think overall, still growing at a healthy clip across the business. Some are probably between 20 and 30% top line and bigger bottom line. But the tougher comps, like to give Jason's point, the tougher comps are coming and all of the things that we've been setting up are coming. So you guys know how this is. You run a consumer business and you've got a whole bunch of bets that you start 12, 18, 24 months out. And there's a lot of waiting and then they start to hit. So for us, the next 60 days is a pretty big period. We have a lot of stuff set in physical retail and we have several new products drop and we're doing a lot of interesting things that if they work out could, you know, double the value of the company, but they're not easy things. They're not things that we're definitely going to be successful at, which is, you know, part of what makes it fun and also what makes it kind of scary. I think for us, one of the big achievements was, obviously we're in a category, it's got a lot of names. You've got some companies like Stanley's been really hot. Something that's pretty fun is we went into Whole Foods this year and we have an item that's, it was number four. We have the number four SKU in an entire category of their store. And that includes all of hydration and a whole bunch of other stuff. So we've gone into a place with all the other big brands where we're at more premium prices than we've usually been and we're competing really well. So that's a good indicator. But a lot of the story is going to be told over the next, I would say, probably 60 days of how the year has gone for us. So it's, you guys know how it is. It's like, you know, butterflies and kind of exciting and kind of stressful. And I'm excited to see what happens in Q2.
So for us, Q1 is the smallest quarter of the year. And then Q3 is, you know, a little bit bigger. Q2 is huge. Q4 is, you know, like that's like the spotlight is similar to you guys. You said the next 60 days are important. Is Mother's Day big for you? Is Father's Day big for you, Mike? I would love to know.
It's less about the holidays for us. I mean, the two kind of, I think, seasonal things that are the two seasonal things that are the biggest for us are back to school and Christmas, although we've started doing these kind of seasonal drops around holidays and that's gone really well. The thing that actually makes the calendar work out this way is we've got a couple of product launches and we've got a couple of major retailers changing over their set. So like this is an interesting thing going on with us. We are a partner of Walmart's and in addition to Target and a whole bunch of other people. And for a long time, Walmart was really hesitant to do any kind of higher price point items. And so they were saying to us like, hey, we want your best stuff. And we were saying, well, you guys aren't really willing to support the price points. And we kind of went back and forth on this for, gosh, I don't know, you know, months, years. And then really recently they started to say like, okay, we just want your best stuff. We don't care about the price point. And as long as it's good value, you know, we don't care if it's a higher nominal price point. And so we're going live with some stuff in there that's, you know, at much higher price points than they've traditionally done and that we've traditionally done there. And so that's really interesting. And it'll be interesting to see how that goes. Similar with Target, there's a whole reset coming in Target. And then it's interesting in mass retail because you get such a big data set when something sets. They'll be like, okay, this is supposed to go live on, 6/1. And the first 5 or 6 days, stores are kind of rolling it out in terms of like performance varies in terms of how quickly they get it out compared to when they're supposed to get it out. But then once it's set, I mean, you're getting basically hundreds of thousands of data points every day. You've got, like with Target, we might have 50 items and in 2,000 stores. So, okay, that's 100,000 different bottle facings. And so basically once you get 2, 3, 4 days of data, you like know what the year looks like. It's wild. It's like you're like waiting, and then boom, they tell you the whole year almost. And you get a feel of like how it's going to go. So you guys can imagine what that would be like, Sean, if it was like, I mean, Father's Day is kind of like that, and that it's like, it's all this buildup and then like, boom, we got to kill Father's Day. Mass retail is a little bit different in that, the seasonality isn't as intense, but you do have this kind of card flip over moment where it's like, okay, this is what we're putting out there. How's it going to go? How's that compare to our forecast? How's that set us up for the future? So that plus the product launches are the big things we have coming up.
Hell yeah, man. Thanks for the in-depth. I think we ended on a very strong e-com focus, brand building focus. For us, Q1, it was our fourth quarter in a row of over $25 million in sales. So
congrats, man. That's a big deal.
Yeah. You know, last year we obviously did over $100 million, but because like over 50% of our revenue comes in Q4, it can look small, huge. And now like we're finally hitting a place where like, even in off periods, we can drive pretty decent volume. So we're also in the, I think this year we're in the 200 club. So me, Mike, we're only like what, 5 years
behind.
That's
worthy of balloons. They're the balloons. We're that's worthy of the balloons.
Yeah. We're only 5 years behind Jason is what it sounds like. We'll catch you, big dog.
I hope you do.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening to the Operators Podcast. I think it was pretty good. This will go out there. Talk to everybody later.
All right. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We want to send a special thank you to our sponsors, Sendlane, Northbeam, and Fulfill. And we'll see you back here next week.